Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo Is There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm kicking off a new series. And as I've done a couple of times when I kicked off a new series, the podcast itself and the Comfort Reads series, I decided to keep things close to home and have my good buddy Colin over to talk about what we're going to be talking about. So hi, Colin.
Hey there.
Thanks for joining me.
You bet.
And this is the first in the Foundational Fantasy series. And in science fiction and fantasy fandom, there can be a lot of gatekeeping. And my intention with this series is to throw the gates wide. And so I think we've talked over the years, you've mentioned, even though you have two science fiction podcasts, one that we're on together and one you're on with Phil.
Yeah.
You are more of a fantasy fan. And so my idea here is I'm more of a science fiction fan. And so with Foundational Fantasy, what I want to do is talk to people who are more attached to the fantasy genre and have them kind of throw titles at me and talk about what it means to them, what fantasy is, what fantasy is to them, what fantasy means to them, you know, what this particular title meant to them in their lives, and just kind of try and borrow that enthusiasm and find my way into fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the whole idea here. So I want to kind of start, people already know you, so I don't think we need to do a...
No, I've been around the block a few times.
Yeah. But like I said, what I kind of want to crowdsource over this series, what is fantasy? Because I think, like I said, there's lots of gatekeeping and some people will be like, oh, fantasy is just swords and elves and wizards, right? In forests. But there's a lot of different subgenres. It's such a massive genre that, you know, I don't want to make you pigeonhole it into one thing. But like, if you're asked on the street, what is fantasy as a genre? Where do you go?
Boy, you know, that's hard to say. You know, people make the same kind of attempts to define science fiction. The parent speculative fiction is a little bit easier, but you know, if you were to ask somebody on the street science fiction, they would tell you Star Wars or Star Trek
and robots
and robots, right? But lasers. A lot of those things are quite fantastic these days, mm-hmm. right? You know, laser swords and the Force and, you know, teleportation and time travel. And the same kind of thing I think happens with fantasy. The classic fantasy is magic and swords and castles and mm-hmm. wars and battles. And to be like super stereotypical, especially, you know, from the time where I was growing up, mm-hmm. it's the young man that goes on a quest to get the sword and defeat the bad guy. And mm-hmm. There's a whole lot of fantasy that's encompassed by that.
So if I pinned you down, though, what do you say?
So to set aside urban fantasy, I would go with that, right? We're talking about things that tend to happen in the past. Mm-hmm. There is a quest involved. There can be epic battles. There's usually magic, although not exclusively. Mm-hmm. There's usually some, you know, special weaponry or talent that's involved on the part of the hero. Mm-hmm. Although not exclusively again. I've read most of my fantasy tends to fall into that category because after Tolkien, there was this recipe found and that's what they sold. And so book after book after book were variations on those themes. And every once in a while, there would be some outstanding things that popped out like Ursula K. Le Guin, Andre Norton, mm-hmm. Anne McCaffrey. And, you know, we could just go on and on and on with the counterexamples. Right. Mm-hmm. You know, stereotypically, I think you're going to be talking about, you know, the quest to get the weapon or the item or the magic gem. And
okay. And so if there's anybody out there right now whose blood is just boiling at what Colin said, don't worry about it. You know, other guests will have their say as well. And like I said, we're going to just kind of crowdsource what fantasy is. And so just because for Colin that this is what the definition is, that doesn't mean it's what the definition is. Because lots of times I think, you know, you kind of end up, all right, let me back up. I was doing zoomed out episodes for a while on genres, and I did one with my sister about urban fantasy.
Right.
It's a very specific little niche of fantasy. But there's lots of other kinds, and I'd reached out to some people, and if you're out there and I tried to get you to come on to do an epic fantasy one, I don't remember who you are, and I don't remember how I reached out to you. So we can still do that. But I think this series is going to kind of help me dive into that without doing it as one plunge into one of the subgenres. Mm-hmm. Because not everything's set on Earth, right? It could be a secondary world. I mean, even like Narnia, right? Definitely fantasy.
Definitely.
Partly on Earth, but partly, you know, it's portal fantasy, right? It's another subgenre.
Yeah.
When I picture it, and this is just kind of me coming from the non-fantasy fan, you know, I picture pretty similar things to what you're talking about. And lots of times the canonical races of men and humans, sorry, let's be inclusive.
Right.
And dwarfs and elves and wizards, right? And that kind of tends to be the way things work. And maybe talking animals of various kinds and magic.
Right.
And so that's kind of where I've always looked at it. And I know that the genre is much more than that.
Well, I think the cool thing is while the genre may have started that way and became popular that way,
yeah.
It has grown, you know, to be all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. You know, I mentioned those are the things that, you know, I fell in love with as a young man mm-hmm. and as an old man and still do enjoy. But there are other aspects of fantasy which are just, you know, incredible.
Yeah, yeah. So the other aspect of this, when I call it foundational fantasy, I think the temptation is to think, oh, what's the first thing that I read, right? And so I'd be doing nothing but children's books.
Right.
Because that tends to be what people come to. But I don't want to limit it to that. But if you're out there and you're like, I want to talk about the Prydain books, well, yes, definitely, absolutely. I want to do an episode on all five of those books. So whenever you want to, that can happen. But, you know, it can also be just foundational in terms of it fostered your love of reading, and it was something you came to when you were in high school, or something that brought you back to reading or back to fantasy. We were talking with James today, and I was like, you know, something that got you through deployment in the Navy, right?
Right.
So maybe we'll circle back and do that with James at some point. But like I said, the gate's wide open. Foundational can mean whatever you want it to mean. It doesn't have to mean it's, you know, super classic or the first thing that you read. When I mentioned that we're going to do this, I was absolutely sure you're going to pick Lord of the Rings, right? Because uh-huh. I know you're rereading it right now.
Yeah, I just started it.
Yeah. I mean, we've been talking about this for months. Or you're going to pick, you know, Shannara, however it's pronounced.
Or Dragonbone Chair. Or, I mean, right. There's so many things you could pick.
Yeah, yeah. Or just, you know, you're like, hey, let's do another episode on Prydain, right? Because we did that for Comfort Reads.
Yeah.
But that was more about what the book meant to us than talking about the book itself, right? That's why I kind of want to circle back and do those ones again. Plus, I just want to read them again, mm-hmm. Which I'm just going to do anyway.
It's time for Comfort Reads again. We did this about 8 years ago, right?
Yeah. Yeah. What's the common ground here? when the real world sucks, sometimes you want to escape into a fantasy world, right?
Yeah.
I was a little surprised at your pick, and why don't you go ahead and say it? And of course, if you're looking at the podcast player, you already know, but, you know, go ahead.
Yeah, so I picked Redwall by Brian Jakes.
Yes.
Yeah.
And to me, this was a bit of a surprising pick, just because I looked at the publication date, and it was like, well, this came out when Colin was in high school. I was in junior high. Mm-hmm. Probably not something that he read, you know, at the receptive age for it.
Maybe not.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, somebody asked Brian Jakes why his books were so popular with not only children, but adults. And he says that he never tried to write books just for children. He just tried to write a good yarn. Mm, yeah. And that's a direct quote.
Yeah.
I mean, they're just great stories. They're light, they're approachable, they're fun, they're clean.
Okay.
And then, kind of fostered, I think, by his original book, Redwall, which he wrote. He came up with these stories when he was the milk driver for a school of the blind. And so he wanted to develop a set of stories for them that were really rich in sensory information. And he threw in the visual, even though they didn't understand it, but he brought it in there so it wasn't excluded. Mm-hmm. But when you talk about, you know, texture and feeling and taste and hearing, it's really rich to read and vibrant. And he writes well. Mm-hmm. So
this is my first Brian Jakes. So you know anything else about the author you want to talk about?
Yeah, so Brian Jakes has had a pretty varied career. He was he had a talk show on the BBC for a while. Mm-hmm. He was a dock worker. I mentioned that he was also a milk truck driver for a while. Mm-hmm. I think he spent some time as a boxer as well. Mm. And so, and then just, ends up writing these stories that he gives to the kids and reads to the kids at the school for the blind. And a friend of his picks up the Safeway bag with the 800 handwritten pages of the book and takes it to a publisher. And that's the inception of Redwall.
Wow.
And that was, you know, published in 1986. He published 21 total stories in the series, going, you know, way after the time of Redwall, way before the time of Redwall, out into the ocean fighting pirates and corsairs, and then, you know, exploring under the mountains, kind of goes all over and just continues to develop and does a really good job developing this great land and story.
Yeah.
All with, you know, clean characters who are rewarded for their bravery and courage, put in difficult times and difficult situations, you know, invasions, disease, overcoming slavery and other issues. They're great fun reads.
Now, so let's move into talking just a little bit about, you know, kind of what the book is, because it's a very particular kind of fantasy. There are no humans.
No, it is anthropomorphic. So that we're at an abbey, which is housing mice and voles and moles and badgers and rabbits and hares and otters. and they are being attacked by the evil vermin.
Right.
You know, rats and ferrets and stoats and mm-hmm. all kinds of bad yes. people.
And fox, double-dealing foxes.
And double-dealing yeah. foxes, yes.
Yeah. So how did you come to this book? Because like I said, it came out, you were, I think you were in high school at that point, right?
Yeah, I was in high school, but I didn't find the book until like 95 or 96.
Okay.
I was shopping at Safeway and I would go past the paperback book section, which no longer exists because right. there are no more paperback books.
Right.
And I saw this book and I had actually read some not fully anthropomorphic fantasy when I was in college. I had read Tad Williams' one of his earlier books, Tail Chaser Song, which is a fantasy story about cats.
Okay.
And since I was a cat person, that worked for me.
Yeah.
And it was a lead in to his incredibly popular work called The Dragonbone Chair. And the series is Memory, Sorrow, and Thorn, which he developed in the 90s and then is revisited about, you know, 5-6 years ago with another 3 or 4 book set of books.
Mm-hmm.
So when I saw this book, I thought, hey, I'll just give that a shot. You know, paperback books for cheap, $6.99. Why not?
Yeah.
And was completely surprised by what I found.
Wow.
Just totally delightful. And so when I had kids and started to read to them out loud, which, you know, all parents are supposed to, we went through a whole bunch of the books.
Yeah.
And then found out that, you know, there were audiobooks, full cast audiobooks with special effects and music to go with them. So we could listen to those. And then right at about the time my oldest son was born, Nelvana from Canada started making animated versions of 3 of the books.
Films. Or television.
Television series, yeah. And so you could watch those on PBS. So we, you know, recorded them on the DVR and would watch them with the kids when they were old enough to understand it. And
Okay, so this is surprising because I was trying to guess at what the story was, right, of you finding them. And I figured you must have found them after your kids were born.
No.
And they were old enough for it. So just walking through Safeway, that's interesting.
Yeah.
There's definitely I missed that paperback section or just the little display they used to have in the Safeway that I went to as a kid, at the Diamond Center Mall in Anchorage, Alaska. They had, comic books and stuff in a little one standing wire turntable kind of things.
Yeah.
And they had paperbacks and stuff on there as well. Yeah, those were the days.
Yeah, I miss those days. Like you could go to your library and hunt for the kind of a book that had the right cover or the right font, the right words in it. You could find it. And now, I mean, well, at least the Hillsborough Library is so busy that if you see something that interests you, you put a hold request on it and wait 8 to 10 weeks to get it. And
So do you have a whole collection of these at your house?
I have all 21 books.
Wow.
And because I read them all from cover to cover. I've read through the series several times over the last 30 years. The boys have read all the books. Kathy enjoys reading the books, or actually enjoyed listening to me read the books. In 2005, which was before all the series were done, they actually published the Redwall Cookbook. And Brian came overseas and went on tour through the United States. And so we took the boys down to go meet him at the old church in Portland. So we were sitting in the front row and the person from Powell's is doing their spiel talking about Redwall. And Mr. Jakes is sitting in the front row pulling faces at Peter and Tim, right? Because they're, you know, just little kids back then. And he was a delight.
Nice. The old church is as close as we can get to Redwall Abbey in Portland.
Pretty much.
Yeah. Nice. So yeah, like you mentioned, anthropomorphic, secondary world kind of stuff, right? There's no idea in this that humans have ever existed.
Right.
It's an abbey, but that doesn't necessarily imply Christianity, right?
They tend to hold what we would call like Christian morals and ethics. Like their goal is to help and provide for the woodlands around them. But there's no proselytizing. There's no concept of sin and judgment.
Right.
There's a rat invasion around the abbey.
Yeah.
The rats are welcome to come in and have their wounds treated and to get some food.
Yeah.
But that's not what they want. They want the abbey in control of everything. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, let's talk a little bit about what the actual novel is about, right? Because there's the Redwall mice, mostly mice, right? The abbot is a mouse.
Yeah.
And it establishes that they are these, you know, kindly force for good in the world, right? And so they, if somebody's wearing the habit of the Redwall Abbey, they are unmolested in the world, even by predator species.
That's right.
Because they know that any creature that is wounded or in need of care can come to the abbey.
Right.
Which is very cool. It's kind of Franciscan, right? St. Francis of Assisi kind of idea, without the trappings of Christianity necessarily. The idea is, right, preach the gospel at all times. If necessary, use words.
Right.
Show by your actions, you know, what kind of person you are.
Yeah, they demonstrated who they were.
Yeah.
And that's more important than, you know, yelling or barking at somebody sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm coming to this brand new, right? And you said, okay, sure, go ahead and read it, but you got to check out the full cast audio.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because Brian Jakes is from Liverpool. Mm-hmm. And it's a, the Liverpool accent is one with a lot of kind of sibilance to it. A lot of, you know, CHs and SHs kind of to it. And it can be this sort of gargling marbles kind of accent when you hear somebody with a really thick one. Like if you watch the, Adolescence, the show that was just, it won a bunch of Emmys, with Stephen Graham.
Okay.
It can be, it's one of the more challenging accents to understand for non-British people and even for some Brits. Mm. So I was a little skeptical at first when I heard, oh, it's that accent. Okay. You know, it's not the most clear diction like Phil has, right?
Right.
But it brought such a hominess to it. I felt really grounded it in the location and the, at the end when the credits were rolling and said, you know, this was recorded in Liverpool. I'm like, yeah, I can tell. Because it's like, Matthias has a Liverpool accent as well, but it's not nearly as
pronounced
as Brian Jakes.
Yeah.
But yeah, so if you're going to check this one out, I definitely recommend the full cast audio, and it has, you know, every line of the book is in it. It's not
abridged.
It's not a radio play.
Right.
But it's, I would say when you mentioned Redwall, I was picturing it like Prydain or Chronicles of Narnia or any kind of more, something that skews towards children's fiction, mm-hmm. picturing it as very, very light. Right. And I found it a meatier book than I expected.
Yeah.
In a good way.
There's a lot of really serious subjects that pop up in there.
Yeah.
You know, people are, in fact, I was listening to the audiobook to get ready for this talk, and I went through the part where Matthias is going to climb outside of Redwall to try and find the Sword of Martin, which is mm-hmm. the big quest they're trying to do because right. he needs a sword to protect the Abbey from Cluny. And they capture one of the sparrows that live above them, mm-hmm. and they put a collar on her and put her under a cage and then, you know, taunt and tease her. And I'm thinking, this is really not the best demonstration of the, you know, the ethics and the morals of Redwall Abbey going on here.
Yeah, yeah.
It all gets overturned as later on, but you know, it was still in there. Mm-hmm. And you know, characters you come to know die, mm-hmm. and you know, the snake Asmodeus is roaming around outside. Yes. If you like the full cast audio, the animated series has a better Asmodeus voice.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I like Clooney's voice better too, but.
Okay. Okay. Well, we'll talk about that. I mean, we haven't really talked about what the actual book is about. We just kind of set the setting of it.
Right.
So you want to give us a quick sort of what's the plot?
Right. So in Redwall Abbey in the Mossflower Woods, there's a word that people use, parents use it on their kids. Eat your food. Otherwise Clooney might come. Don't stay outside after dark. Clooney could be hiding there. Mm-hmm. Clooney the Scourge, this rat and his horde of other rats and animals are used and are like infamous throughout the whole area. Well, it turns out that Clooney is actually on his way to the Abbey and makes himself known. And you know, the Abbey starts ringing the bell of alarm, and you know, they draw in all the local woodlanders, and an assault of the Abbey begins. Mm-hmm. And in order to protect the Abbey, they think they need the sword of Martin the Warrior, because most of the Abbey, almost all the Abbey dwellers are all peaceful creatures.
Right.
A few people have some experience with war and battle. Like there's Constance the Badger, who's big enough to pick up a wagon and throw it at somebody.
Yeah.
And Jess the Squirrel and a whole bunch of people. But really the star, the main person we're working with is the young novice Matthias, mm-hmm. who we're introduced to tripping over his own sandals in the habit because they don't have anything in his size.
Right, right. Well, the role of a monk doesn't really fit him.
No. He's actually destined for other higher things. Mm-hmm. And that's revealed when they, where Clooney sends a spy in to steal a tapestry of the Abbey's protector, Martin the Warrior, from the olden days, hundreds and hundreds of seasons ago. And he knows that if he steals that, it will demoralize them. And so he sends in his spy to steal it. Gets control of it, and now they're on this quest to try and get the tapestry back. But behind there is a riddle, and it says how to find Martin's sword.
Right.
And it insinuates that perhaps somebody named Matthias could be the person to wield it. And everyone's a little confused, like, Matthias, the guy that trips over his own sandals? Mm-hmm. But in this process, Matthias is actually starting to mature as a mouse. Mm-hmm. And an Abbey dweller, and finds that while he holds to the standards of the Abbey, he's actually designed and intended for other higher, different things, mm-hmm. to be a warrior. And so his quest is to help solve the riddles and to go on the quest to get the sword and try to rescue some of the people that Clooney has captured.
And so, like, if you're somebody, and I want to talk about this Maybe we'll come back to this after we kind of talk more about the book, about like, if you like this kind of book, you might like this. This is probably a good time to talk about it. And like for anybody who hasn't necessarily read it and is like, well, maybe I want to read it before they get into spoilers. Mm-hmm. What I would say is that if you like a fantasy story with a main character, with a true heart, right? With a very noble person, not perfect.
No,
because he definitely is not as mature as he could be at times. He rushes off into things. And you know, that makes him a more interesting character, right? Was it a good idea to leave the Abbey right now?
Yeah. Especially when they depended on him as part of the people guiding the Abbey in times of war.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, yeah, if you're somebody who likes like Peter from Chronicles of Narnia, right. Or Taran from the Prydain books, mm-hmm. right. Somebody who's very pure of heart and pure of intention, not always perfect in act. Then this is something I think would be right up your alley. So I don't know if you have any other comps for Redwall that you would throw out there. You mentioned a couple, Tad Williams and other things.
Yeah. So if you were to think about Prydain and Narnia as books that you would read to young children, mm-hmm. I would say that these books are more for like upper elementary, middle school.
Yeah.
And then the Dragonbone Chair series, Memory, Sorrow, and Thorn, high school and beyond, because there's some, fairly adult things that happen in there. Although nowadays people tend to mature so early, it's hard to tell.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, and there's hewing of heads and not like graphic eviscerations or anything like that. Right. But,
no.
People fall from walls and get broken in various ways. There's just plain old murder a couple times.
Yeah.
Which Matthias is horrified by, as he should be, anyone should be.
The Terry Brooks books, the first trilogy, I would say those would be, kind of in this same vein.
Okay. Which series?
Shannara.
Okay. So just a couple more, we'll just talk a little more and then just jump into, spoilers and talk about the plot a little bit.
Okay.
We've danced around it a little bit. And if this is a little messy, it's because it's the first one and I don't know what I'm doing yet. So I'm going to crowdsource my own podcast as well. I'm the crowd, but we'll get it honed mm-hmm. over time. The book reminded me a little bit of The Sword and Stone at times, because it was Matthias would go from place to place to, on a quest.
Right. Right.
And there's a little Indiana Jones in it as well, which was really a lot of fun.
Yeah.
The thing that you mentioned, and I don't know, maybe this is better for spoilers. Why don't we just go into spoilers? How about that?
Okay, sure.
Yeah. So like you mentioned, there's the siege. And I remember when I was reading the book, I was reading it on an e-reader. And so you can't really tell how far you are through unless you have the percentage going or something. I tend to keep that off because I don't want... occasionally I'll be like, how many pages left? Tap the thing to see me how many pages left in the chapter.
Yeah.
But sometimes I get a sense of, oh, I'm getting towards the conclusion of this book, right? And there's the first siege. And I'm like, wow, this is a much shorter book than I thought because it does not go well for the rats. And then I looked at it and I turned back on like, okay, I'm 120 pages into this and it's, 300 some pages. So there's time for the attack and then fall back, another attack, grievous wounds for Clooney, right? Maybe that's all in the first one. I guess it's after they've fallen back and then they try going up the tree, right?
With
the
plank. Right, yeah. Run this distraction at the front gate while we take this plank over there and try and go over the elm tree into the abbey from the side.
Yeah, yeah. And that doesn't work because Constance, who is just... I love the name Constance because it sounds like constant, right? And she's always there and she's always just ready to take her cudgel and wallop on some rats.
Exactly. Or pick them up by their tail and throw them into a tree.
Yeah,
or...
yeah, yeah. And so that's always a lot of fun. But at some point, Martin kind of has this conviction that if we could only find the sword of Martin the Warrior,
right?
Then, and maybe this is a question. Is the sword magic?
If you could say that it inspires people and causes them to try and do their best and be their best for the right things, I say that that is magic. In the same way that we say there's magic in Santa Claus.
Sure.
Right?
Sure, sure.
But in like inherent magic?
Okay. I mean, the fact that it hasn't rusted tells me there's something uncanny about it.
Yeah, I think that's Handwavium, though.
Yeah, yeah.
If there is magic in this story, it comes from some of the dreams and the visions and the prophecies that are left with the riddles to take people places to place.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, that reminded me a little bit of the Gregor the Overlander series where there's prophecies in that, right? And that's kind of it's not the only supernatural thing. Also, there's life-size, 6-foot rats and that kind of thing, and 6-foot bats.
Yeah.
And a whole subterranean world. But the prophecies are another part of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, he starts searching for clues. And one of the clues is, like you mentioned, Clooney, the Scourge. And we will talk about Clooney.
Okay.
He sends in a spy who's, I think, a ferret or a stoat or weasel of some kind, right? To cut down the tapestry.
Oh, Shadow?
Shadow.
Yeah, no one really knows what he is. He's very dark from his eyes to the tips of his fur.
Yeah, yeah. And so he goes in, cuts down the tapestry to take it to Clooney to use as a war banner, essentially.
Right. To demoralize, you know, I'm taking their mascot, you know, their founder. So. Mm-hmm.
And part of it is he's frightened of Martin.
He's been having dreams.
Yeah, yeah. And so after that, but it in true like Indiana Jones kind of fashion, right? And in fun fiction fashion, cutting that down revealed the first clue.
Yes.
To where the sword is. And so they find this writing on the wall, which is very biblical, right?
Yes.
And they tease it out into this poem that has the phrase, I am that was.
I am that is.
I am that is.
Yes.
Which they at some point unscramble and go, oh, that's Matthias. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that he was like the milk truck driver for a school for the blind.
Brian Jakes was, yes.
And so I was marveling when I was reading it at how well drawn, and I use that metaphorically, the scenes were for kind of how the quest worked. And it sounds very much like Indiana Jones, right? It's on this step, there's these letters and you have to, there's something that you need to dig up there, go get the moles and they'll dig it up for us. Right.
Right.
And it was all very vivid. Like I felt like I could just map it all out in my head, and that's really an accomplishment. So I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, he's an incredible storyteller, mm-hmm. and he's very vivid in his writing. If I were to tell you that somebody was a dock worker and a milk truck worker, you might not think that's the kind of thing that they do. But mm-hmm. when I just finished this podcast with Phil Nichols this morning, mm-hmm. where most of the people that wrote the short stories for Asimov's were not professional writers.
Right.
They were just random people, because very, very few people can make a living selling, you know, their writing. And, you know, Brian Jakes was one of the fortunate people to do that. Mm-hmm. Although he kind of fell into it by accident.
Right.
So,
right.
Well, and the quests end up continuing, because it turns out that the sword is not where Martin left it in right. The abbey. It was stolen by the sparrows, and then it was stolen by an adder. And that ends up being like the final quest for Matthias, to try and travel through Mossflower on his own again, not mm-hmm. the wisest thing to do,
right?
To where the snake is. So first he has to figure out where the snake is, and has to, you know, kind of go through the guardians on his way to the snake, which mm-hmm. were an owl and a cat.
Well, and the sparrows.
And the sparrows, yeah. Sure. And the shrews, Gausam.
Yes.
Guerrilla Union of Shrews in Mossflower. Yes. That is the other thing he does really well, and this is throughout many of the books, mm-hmm. is he'll come up with these crazy acronyms. Mm-hmm. So there's, you know, Gausam, there's Corum, the Council of Resistance in Mossflower. Mm-hmm. There's, I forgot what the Dibbons are, but there's one is... the young animals inside the abbey have an organized resistance against bedtime. And I can't remember what that acronym is.
But children would latch right onto that.
Yeah, yeah. And so it's just great storytelling, and it's funny mm-hmm. and epic and exciting and fun. And
yeah. Well, and like we've hinted at, the characters are great. Because Matthias is a fun character, you know, you're like, oh, buddy, you know, take somebody with you, you know? yeah. But then like Clooney the Scourge, who's this great, almost mythological character, he's a rat with a super long tail that he can use like a whip.
Yes, right? The Scourge.
And he has a poison dart that he puts at the end of it, right, mm-hmm. to murder people with. But, you know, he inspires by terror, right? None of his followers love him. They're just all terrified of him.
Right, yeah. They're afraid of him, but covet his power and his position and mm-hmm. his army.
Yeah, and so he has a whole series of, you know, lieutenants who are at various levels of inept and useless.
Yeah. Well, and the backstabbing mm-hmm. and the plotting against one another and the preening. In fact, you remember the story where Constance makes a giant bow to try and kill Clooney?
Yeah.
And Clooney has set up a decoy, so he has somebody in his tent putting on his armor.
Right, but Clooney didn't know that, right? He tells that story.
Yeah,
but it was, I can't remember which it was. I can't remember all the names of the rats.
Yeah,
One of his lieutenants, maybe it was Cheese Thief,
Red Fang.
Might have been Red Fang. They're great names. Yes. But I just can't necessarily keep them straight. But he decides he wants to try on the armor to feel like dad, you know?
Yes.
and he puts it on just in time for Constance to see his shadow in there and go, oh, there's Clooney, you know? And that's how he dies. And then when Clooney discovers that, he tells the story to his men of, this was my cunning plan.
Yes. Right. Yeah, he was going to betray us, and so I set him up in there as a decoy. And
yeah, yeah. And it has resonances in the way that that certain people in power use the media to get ahead of the story, to brand people as domestic terrorists before any actual information comes out, before everybody's seen all the video and can tell.
Yeah.
Maybe not. But that's what evil people do. So we don't get political here.
Not too much.
but yeah. And then Asmodeus is this almost force of vengeance or like the personification of death. Because that's what happens is, you know, people go on misadventures and stray from the path and all of a sudden Asmodeus.
Yeah.
I think at some point, Matthias tied up one of the rats, right? Knocked him out and tied him up.
Right.
And just as the rat frees himself, Asmodeus says, you did me a huge favor untying yourself. Now I can drag you away from here.
And in fact, some of the rats see him being drug away with his face being all bloated and swollen and his tongue hanging out.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's not a lack of grim images in the book. So even though it's for children, I don't think it's unsuitable because of that, because, you know, people see their pet mouse die sometimes. Mm-hmm. Sometimes people see their pet guinea pig carried into the living room by their friend's dog. That happened in my house.
Oh.
It was my dog, my friend's guinea pig. R.I.P. Cow. That was his name, Cow.
That's a challenge to a friendship.
Yes. Yeah, we were not good pet sitters. I lost a pet turtle. Turtle ran away. Turtle ran away from my house.
In Alaska.
Yeah, in Alaska. So I had no idea what happened there. One minute it was on the grass, and I don't know if an enterprising cat came along or something, but I don't know. Anyhow. The story is, if you ever go back in time to the 80s in Anchorage, don't let the Heasleys sit your animals.
Yeah.
It does not end well. But then, yeah, like Constance is great. And the abbot, you know, is this very sweet person who realizes the necessity of defense, right? Mm-hmm. But can't be the one leading it and recognizes that I can't be the one leading it.
Right.
And sees something in Matthias so that toward the end of the book, right? Says, you should not take up the habit of the Redwall monk, right?
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, I think he gives Cornflower to Matthias in marriage.
Yeah, more or less saying, both of you don't take the vows. Yeah. of I don't know if they have, you know, vows of chastity or anything like that, but the abbot didn't seem to be married.
No, so. I don't think he was.
Yeah. But I think he recognized that they were a good match. And the two of them recognized it as well.
Oh yeah, they had been flirting the whole book.
Yeah, I do like some of the use of language, like you said, with the acronyms, with some of the names are fun, and just having things like one of the very poor families, the Church Mouse family, right?
Yeah,
which I think that's just, it's such a good use of the idiom, right? Of poor as a church mouse. Mm-hmm.
And they lived in a church,
right?
St. Ninians.
Yes, even though it invites questions of. What's a church in this, you know, like, are there humans and we just don't know about it? Does the Redwall series ever reveal that?
There are never humans in the series.
Okay.
I was going to say the founder of St. Ninian's church is revealed.
Okay.
In the second book, but.
Another favorite character and a tremendous one on the audiobook is Basil Staghair.
Oh my God. Yes, for sure. Yeah. I think he has the best line in the entire book. When Jess Squirrel and Basil Staghair go to retrieve the scrap of Martin's tapestry. Mm. His job is to be a distraction while Jess goes and pulls it off of his standard, because that's what it's become. It's become part of his standard along with a bird skull and something else.
Yeah.
And Clooney yells, I want his head! And up pops Basil Staghair, camouflage expert and foot soldier, mm-hmm. saying, what's wrong? Own head not good enough?
Yeah, he's definitely good with the one-liners and just giving everybody a bunch of crap.
Yes,
and then giving them those two big feet of rabbitdom to the face.
Oh yes,
and hiding and making them look like fools, right?
Bob and weave.
Yes, yeah. And he kind of teaches Matthias some of the art of stealth as well, because when he first Martin sallies off on his. On his lonesome, right? By his lonesome several times. And that's how he comes across these various people. And one of the first ones that he meets is Basil, yes. who just pops up out of nowhere as Matthias is realizing, wow, I've got to get across that entire open space without being seen. That can't be done. And then Basil Hare's like, oh, just go this way. What?
Yeah. The Hares are actually a story all unto themselves. Hmm. Along with the badgers, and their stories of those tribes of animals are kind of interrelated.
Okay,
so as you get in toward like the tens of books, that's all revealed, and it's delightful.
One of the other sort of fantasy elements is the way Martin kind of comes to Matthias at critical times, mm-hmm. right? It's like the spirit of his ancestor. Almost, right? And I kept expecting there to be the rote thing you would expect, and maybe this is in future books, that reveal the lineage of Martin, you know, and down to Matthias through Methuselah or, you know, whoever. I actually at some point thought, okay, Methuselah is going to reveal he was actually Martin. He's really old.
like a Galahad reveal or something.
Yeah.
In an Arthurian legend.
Yeah, something like that. But I was glad it didn't go that way.
Yeah. So Brian Jakes did not write many sequels. I think out of the 21 books there were, and you know, someone who knows Redwall much better than me is going to correct me. I want to say there were two sequels to Redwall. There's one sequel to Joseph the Bellringer, and there's another sequel in The Legend of Luke. So there is a little bit of lineage that happens. So, you know, the Luke the Warrior is Martin the Warrior's father. Mm. And then Martin comes down into Mossflower hundreds of years ago and it helps them overthrow the evil cats, which are controlling Mossflower, and they build the abbey in its place with a bunch of mice that come from another place, which has been destroyed in an earthquake, which is also visited in the story. Mm. So every time he builds some piece of mythology into it, he will later go on and develop it out. And sometimes you'll recognize that the recorder of the current story was a child in two or three stories ago. So there's a little bit of way to track who's related to where in time, mm-hmm. but it's not like getting, you know, book after book after book of Matthias or Martin or whomever.
Right. Percy Jackson.
Or Percy Jackson. Yeah. So there's 10 or 12 of those.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that works for him and it's still a good story.
Mm-hmm. One thing that I admired too is the setting up of the bell as being, you know, for whom the bell tolls almost, right?
Yes.
Because every time Clooney is having one of these nightmare visions of Martin the Warrior, who turns out to be Matthias the Warrior, mm-hmm. It ends with him falling or something and then being woken up by the Joseph bell, right? Where it just goes bong and it's great on the audio, mm-hmm. the way they do that. And the way he ties that into the actual events is really fun.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting how... And we're full spoiler, right?
Oh, yeah.
Matthias does not kill Clooney in the end.
Right.
Nobody kills Clooney. Well, mm-hmm. I mean, Matthias does cause him to die, but he doesn't impale him on a sword or burn him in a fire or do anything else. Mm-hmm. He drops the bell on him.
Yeah.
Of all things to possibly do. Mm-hmm. And it was the safest and the right thing to do.
Right. Yeah, he outsmarted him.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways, right? Clooney thought that all of a sudden he had the upper hand and then whack through the supports for the bell and there we go. So yeah, it was a satisfying villain defeat at that point. And then I like the fact that, you know, well, a lot of the rats were killed.
Yeah.
But the abbey still cared for the wounded who needed help.
Yeah, yeah. And once they were recovered and healthy, they would be sent out with some provisions and saying, don't come back. You're not welcome.
Yeah.
And you have to deal with loss, right? Methuselah is killed by Chicken Hound. Mm-hmm. And the abbot is killed in the end by Clooney.
Yeah.
And so there's a succession and handing off that happens.
Right.
So I want to say that Mr. Church Mouse becomes the new church recorder in place of Methuselah. Mm. And Brother Alf, Mort Alphys, mm-hmm. who went fishing with Matthias for the big first Redwall feast,
yes.
catching their grayling.
Yeah.
He becomes Father Mort Alphys. Mm-hmm. And yeah. So there's also, you know, I kind of like a story that doesn't end at the final battle because that's not the way our lives work, right? You have this great big thing that you're working on developing and then your life continues. And that's something that tends to be written. That's one of the way Brian Jakes writes. Mm. And I like it.
Yeah. And it gives a little, you know, and subsequently these things happen, right?
Yeah.
Well,
even the name of the season, the Late Rose, mm-hmm. you learn why that rose is called the Late Rose. Mm. Okay. In subsequent books.
Ah. Is it like the, I don't know if you're aware of the fireweed in northern areas, like mm-hmm. especially in Anchorage, you can kind of set the beginning of winter, the end of summer, with the way the buds on the fireweed go. Mm-hmm. And now I can't remember if it's from the bottom up or the top down. it's been too long, but you could always see it there. They grow all throughout the city. They're these weeds that throw runners that are hundreds of feet long sometimes. I worked as a gardener for a couple summers, and man, they are a real pain because you start pulling one up and it goes all the way down the driveway, you know. But they are pretty.
Okay.
So.
No, it's a varietal of rose that happens to bloom later in the season. And, you know, in this story, it blooms quite late because, you know, everyone kind of loses heart when Martin is stolen from the Abbey.
Right.
And then when it's brought back, you know, it says, oh, the late rose is in bloom now.
I mean, that's sort of a magical element, right? The magic of nature.
Yeah, yeah. But not like, you know, casting spells or drinking potions or, you know.
Right.
Just waving your wands or anything.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that'll be fun to get into in subsequent, you know, discussions on this series of talking about magic systems, mm-hmm. right? Because that's it's like the most science fiction part of some fantasy.
Oh, yeah. Well, and for, you know, what we're reading today, even though it's like, 15, I think, 15 years old now, Brandon Sanderson's Mistborn series is highly scientific in its magic system because he intended to develop a magic system and then carry it forward hundreds and hundreds of years to the point where it was part of the technology.
Interesting. Anything else to say about Redwall? You brought some show and tell with you. It doesn't totally work for radio here, but...
No. I wanted you to see the things because, like I said, you know, it started off with a set of stories told to kids at a blind school, mm-hmm. and there are 21 novels, a cookbook, a handful of related books, like, you know, the Otter Tribe of Redwall, the Badger Tribe of Redwall, a picture book, a graphic novel adaptation. They took three of the books and turned them into animated series. That's the Redwall series. They call them season 1, 2, and 3, mm-hmm. even though they're all completely different stories from one another. Mm. So it's been huge. And even after Mr. Jakes passed away, I think in 2011, it continues. Mm-hmm. So, and people aren't writing new material to the best of my knowledge, but the books just hang around and around and around.
Yeah. Yeah. I mentioned this on the Discord that I'm on that I had just finished reading it. And then I was going to be doing a podcast on it. And JW, who you met in Seattle, was like, ooh, I want to be on that one. I'm like, sorry, dude, I'm not recruiting. I'm just doing, you know, one-on-one kind of things for these. I'm open to doing multiple guests for some of these. If two people reach out to me approximately the same time about the same title, then we can make that work.
Well, there are at least 20 other books to cover. Right. So if you want to pick his favorite that I didn't just do, then yeah.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And because like I said, I don't necessarily want to do a whole series. If somebody wants to pick a book that's in the middle of a series, I will try and do my homework and catch up to it. I had to do that for the Hugos
a few times. For these books, like I said, you don't really have to.
Yeah, yeah. And sometimes, you know, you want to figure out, how does this fit? You know, how does this work for somebody who hasn't read the whole series?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's about it.
Yeah. We could talk about Redwall for a very, very long time.
Yeah, I mean, this is a
great introduction.
We could do it on Take Me to Your Reader because we've got adapted material.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. If you want to see that, let us know and we can move that up the docket. So before you go, in case people are like, I don't know who this Colin guy is, where can people find you?
Well, I do have two other podcasts. There's Take Me to Your Reader, which is a Pavement Pounders podcast. So if you go to PavementPounder.com.
Pavement Podcast.
PavementPodcast.com. Thank you. And with our long-term guest, Phil Nickel from Take Me to Your Reader, I have another podcast called Science Fiction 101. And that's 101sf.blogspot.com. And you can find both those podcasts any place that you listen to audio. I'm also an avid disc golfer. And so if you search for me under the name of Pearl Dreamer, you will find the interactive flight chart that I made that's all JavaScript-based.
Ah, yes. Yeah, good stuff. Well, Colin, thanks for doing this. Thanks for kicking off the series with me.
You're welcome.
For the third time. I think the only one I didn't have you kick off was the zoomed out one. Because you couldn't, I did ask.
You did.
I was like, do you want to do Brandon Sanderson or somebody else? But ultimately I think I found the right guest for doing that. But yeah, this was fun. And it was a fun book to pick up. It might be the kind of thing that I'm like, you know, someday for grandkids, I'd like to read this to somebody.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Well, so if you're out there and you're like, hey, I have some foundational fantasy I would like to talk about, then you can go ahead and reach out to me in the normal ways, feedback@hugospodcast.com, go up to the website, find the contact form. I should make sure that it works.
Yes, please do, because we found out that ours wasn't working on 101SF.
Mine was broken for a while, so I think I fixed it. I will check it though. If you don't hear back from me, because I get an email immediately as soon as somebody sends that through, then just go straight to email or find me on Blue Sky or various other places and let me know what you want to cover. And I would like to do mostly this year. I'm still going to sprinkle in some of my other episodes. I'll probably do Hugo nominees at some point. I have a couple people on the line to do normal episodes, and I haven't forgotten about you, so I will get to you. I have an interesting one of these coming up that's not going to be about books. So this does not have to be limited to books, just because generally the podcast is. Occasionally we cover movies, so I'm going to do one of those. All right. Thanks, everybody. Thanks, Colin. Bye, y'all.